Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Good, that's the best one yet.
I am short.
Pizza, pizza.
Showtime!
Like an inch and a half long.
My wife's not here.
Just swinging in the breeze.
I'd watch Sweet On Me.
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing tech show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the gas, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no fuddy duddies that'll link it bad. For the stream link, go to like the DLNGS.org. And the IC channel is a LinuxLink.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 1097 of the Links Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Joel.
Good evening, and that's it.
Yeah, that's it. Good evening, Joel. Before we fire it off on some stuff, I guess we should wish Mordancy a happy birthday.
Yes.
So happy birthday, happy birthday to you.
And that was horrible, but yeah, but
he's a great guy.
He's a great guy, and every year he has is a blessing right now at this point after going through what he's gone through. So I'm just glad that he's still around.
Absolutely, he designed and printed shirts for us.
T-shirts,
man.
A long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago, man. There was some great stuff. I still have some of those shirts. Well, I mean, I still wear them. Actually, some of them I don't wear anymore.
I don't.
I put them away so they don't get ruined. So I have them for posterity to hand them down like family heirlooms.
Family heirlooms.
As a remembrance of the good times.
I mean, if they lasted, I wouldn't fit into any of them anymore. Since considering I'm wearing large T-shirts instead of, there's no X's in front of any of my shirt sizes anymore. So I mean, good problem to have. 156 pounds down now.
Good, congratulations.
And I'm still on that journey, still doing the proteins and all that. It's weird. Like, when you're trying to hit your protein, I'm like, today I said, well, let's have some fried rice. And then I looked at my macros on that, and I'm like, oh, crap, I still need another 15. Okay, what can I do? Well, I can have a protein shake, so that's easy. All right. But then I was still, like, 7 short, and I'm like, I had a little bit of leftover taco meat. I weighed out 1 ounce and I ate that too. And I'm like, ugh. But I met my protein. So, but it's probably the harder thing now is when I'm trying to hit those numbers is planning out my day. Like for example, tomorrow night I will have a workout, pretty intense workouts. Usually in my boot camp workouts, usually pretty. I mean, it's not like crazy intense, but it's intense enough. But I always take a post workout protein with a glycogen replenishment for my muscles after the workout, and that's another 170 calories. So I got to be careful with how much I eat throughout the day tomorrow, so I can have enough room left for that at the end. But it's worth it, though. I mean, I'm getting stronger every day. Like I'm been working on assisted pull-ups, so I'm gradually starting to put less and less weight on that, with the whole goal on that is to be able to do a real pull-up. So maybe someday I can do a Murph workout, which that's not happening for a while, but we talked a little bit about that last week. That's a pretty intense workout that I can't do yet. But other than that, it's like I got my 5K race coming up in June, and then a week after the first 20-mile hike. And then found out last week that they're moving my mission trip up 1 week. So I had to get that rejiggered on this work schedule, but it also happens that I'm probably going to be going out by myself to join the team because of the last minute change, because the rest of the team's going to leave the day of my second Mammoth March, which I'd already promised I'm doing with we got like last year we have 4 people and we have 7 that are affiliated with my church that are going to do it next year. So, or this coming year, I should say. So then of course I got the one that we're doing in Cuyahoga Valley National Park in September, and then my first 10K. So that's all coming up and training for it and continue to stay on that stick. But the hard one's going to be when I'm in Baton Rouge trying to stay good on the food-wise and trying to find ways to get my exercises in while we're down there.
Well, good luck with that.
My son's pissed that he said that he's not allowed to wear shorts when he's bowling down there. Gotta do what you gotta do. I mean, I don't know if they're gonna have TV because it's a USB-C tournament. They might do like a. There will be some, like, well, the thing is it's not like he's like you see on TV where they're like they bowl for an event and they bowl like during the week, and then they have the TV things that it's completely different than that. Not to mention the fact it goes on for a lot longer than just that weekend. They built the alleys he's going to be bowling on in a convention center like in January. And they've started having squads like February and March, and Luke's squad is in May, Memorial Day weekend actually. So, but it's really wild how they just build all that up in the convention center. Then when the tournament's done, they'll tear it all down. And I guess they do that quite often. I think next year it's supposed to be in Reno. Ain't no way I'm driving there.
Nice.
Get my ass on an airplane. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, there you go.
But yeah, that's the some of the cool thing, like I flew for work before, and because it was such an inconvenient thing, I ended up buying my own. You know how they have the seatbelt extensions for the fat guys? Well, guess what? Joel don't need that no more. 36-inch waist now. Yeah,
nice.
Feeling good. I still haven't taken my photos this week for my transformation challenge. I need to. I haven't done that yet. Or measured, like, my arms and stuff. I can't do that yet.
So before
a few more weeks on that.
What? Go ahead.
Before you went on vacation, what'd you do?
Oh, so, like, before I went on vacation, we ran into an interesting problem at work. And it involved the securing of our functions. And we thought that we were all ready to go. This is the thing where we had to do all that work on the Fastly and the load balancer. And ultimately, the big problem that we had was because of trying to alter the path through Fastly was going... didn't work, but we got it working. And so we were excited, and so we started the process of putting other things into a secure mode, and we have this application called Alerts. Alerts allows you to create an alert, obviously, that it goes out through different channels, and those channels include like email and a text message or whatever that people can sign up for when they subscribe to certain things, and then the journalists or editors can create these alerts for their articles and stuff, and
there's another micro application we have, content list, which is creating list stuff, which also works with alerts. And so there's two things that you can do. You can send an alert immediately, or you can schedule, or what we call embargo an alert. And so when you send the alert immediately, it goes directly out to the function that we're looking to secure and sends the alert out that way. When you embargo or schedule alert, it goes through the Google task scheduler. And so that's just like a queue. And what you do when you create a task is you send along the task in a payload that also includes like when you want that task to be released. It's kind of like scheduling, almost like a cron job to fire off your task. But it's usually like a once and done thing, but you can do it like if you wanted to, almost like a cron task. So I wasn't really involved in the code changes required for that to be made, but what was in a sense required is now when you secure it, you have to send in an OpenID Connect token, an OIDC token, OpenID Connect. And basically that's generated by the Google authentication libraries by using the email address of the service account. And then there's another field called audience that you can include. Anyway, what ended up happening was alerts, when they tested all, I don't know who tested it all, but it was functioning fine. It was able to send alerts in our staging environment to the secured environment, and everything appeared to be going fine. Both applications, content lists and alerts, were working just fine. When we pushed it to production, we started noticing that some alerts were failing, and it turned out it was the scheduled alerts, which was kind of odd because it wasn't content list and alerts application. Both are able to schedule alerts, but only some of them were failing and not all of them that were scheduled. And it turned out that there were the ones that were created through alerts. And so looking at the differences between the two, one of the things that really stood out from the get-go was the alerts application when scheduling an alert was including the audience, a value for the audience, but the content list one wasn't. And it was odd to us at first glance, like, why would that matter? So we went in a huge roundabout way trying to figure out, like, what is the problem here, and not kind of looking at the obvious. And so eventually we got back to audience as to looking at that, and I was like, well, it's not clear why this would fail. And the audience thing had been in there for a long time. Now, obviously, the clearest answer to that is because it was an unsecured function before. So even if you were adding in the OIDC token, it wouldn't have mattered if it's unsecure. It just throws that away. It doesn't need to use that. But it had been in there and it had been used. Now that was in there because a long time ago, this application, the alerts application, was performing all the duties. So the scheduled task that was coming into itself was split off to these functions, that functionality. So, but that OIDC token was still left in there with the audience. Now, I have spoken before that I am not a big fan of AI when I'm doing searches in Google and stuff like that, or trusting AI. It's not that I don't find it in some ways valuable. It can be a helpful tool, but it's one of those tools where you have to follow up on it and make sure that you know what you're doing if you're going to use it. So when I'm looking for information, and I think it is it Gemini in Google that does this?
Yes.
That it will consolidate search results at the top of the sometimes, not every time, but sometimes. And so it'll provide you a synopsis of all the different search results. And what is nice about it is it has the links down there. Now, sometimes I don't like that. Sometimes I do. And so in this case, I kind of pieced together what was going on, but I couldn't find the specific answer that said, this is what's going on. And interestingly enough, like Gemini couldn't find the specific answer either. So I had, and we both came to the same conclusion, which is why I know it was right, right? Because it agreed with my conclusion, Joel. Isn't that how it works? So the way that it operates, when you piece all this information together, and obviously this makes sense, because when we removed the audience value, it worked fine, okay? But including the audience caused it to fail. Now, the reason why is that when you're creating the OIDC token, it particularly in the Google environment, it's using the service account email, and then it's also using audience, which is a value that has to be agreed upon by both sides, the sending and the receiving. So when you're sending the audience token, including the audience value in the OIDC token, the receiving side needs to know what that audience value is going to be, right? So that is one way of verifying that this is a legitimate request and it's authorized to do this. So it's kind of like when you break apart this token, is the service account match? Yes. Does the audience match what we expect it to be? Yes. So the receiving side needs to know the audience. It's like a key. They need to know the key. Makes sense, right? So back when our application, our alerts application, was doing it all, that audience value was a known value that the application sent that request to it, or something got that request in from a scheduled task, and it came into the application, and the audience value would match exactly what we told it was, because we told the receiving end when it runs, this is where you get the audience value from in Google Secrets, and lo and behold, there it is. You know, so it could do that comparison. Now, when we split off that functionality, and the function is running in Google Function Framework, Google Function Framework handles that off that verification, and it has an expectation for what the audience value should be. And the audience value should be the URI of the Google Cloud function that you're sending to. It was hard to kind of track that down. So the reason why it was failing is because we were sending a numerical string for the audience for our alerts application, which was a holdover from a couple years ago. But the content list application, when it was scheduling, was not sending an audience value. Now, what happens is that the way that this works is in the payload you have defined, there is a section for OIDC token generation, and you send, pass in there the service account email of how that token should be created, and then audience is an optional value. If you do not include the audience in your payload for setting up the task, it defaults to the URI of the HTTP task it's sending, it's the function is sending to. So in the case, this is an HTTP triggered function. So it's triggered through an HTTPS post or get call. So when you're setting that up in the Google task for that HTTP function, the URL that you're sending to is in that function. And thus, if you do not include the audience, the token is generated based upon the URI that you're sending to, which is exactly what the Cloud Function Framework expects. So when we were populating the audience with that numerical string value, the Google Cloud Function was not expecting that, and it didn't match the URI. Thus is why it failed authentication and would not allow the function to be triggered. So interestingly enough, you know, that obviously it makes sense, but there was nothing in any of Google's documentation that I could find, or Gemini was able to find, that specifically said that exact thing. You could piece it together because somewhere in the payload description, it talks about creating the OIDC token, and it says, if you go down, dig deep into the specification for it, it says the two values in here are service account email and audience for doing this. Audience is optional. Without audience being included, it defaults to the URI that you're sending to. Somewhere in the Google Cloud documentation framework, you can find that it expects the audience to be the URI value. I don't know how you could possibly change it, but it was hard to dig all that information up. It was very, it could have been simpler if they would have just said in one of their examples, or even in talking about how to authenticate, if they would have said, you know, the Google Cloud Function Framework expects the audience to be the URI. And there isn't a way to change that as far as I know. Maybe there is if you, but I haven't been able to find it. So that was very frustrating. And the thing that was challenging that had to do this is we figured it out. Like, it took a day or two of trying out a whole bunch of different things until we were like, all right, let's get rid of the audience and see what happens, and it works. Okay, so we don't need to use the audience. And we wrote a ticket to say we're going to remove the audience. All the work was done. I go on vacation. Then I come back, and they're like, well, we need to still groom this ticket because we were unclear about whether there's going to be an unintended consequence for removing audience, which is where it comes back to two years ago, when this was being set up as an all-in-one application. One of the guys who was working on it had spoken to another guy about this whole audience token and why it's required and why it needs to be compared. But he had referenced another application, which I spent a couple hours going through that application trying to figure out what the heck was going on here, like talking about using an audience token. But then I come to find out after further probing and asking, it wasn't this other application. It was the one that we were talking about. And this is where that confusion came in as to, you know, setting that audience token and all that. So that added another day or two on. But finally got that deployed out to production today. It's working just fine. And the next problem is that with this in place now, it's going to take, I have to wait a month at least. I can't secure the cloud function until May 29th. And the reason is obviously, because of the embargoed or scheduled alerts, any alert that was created before this application was updated to remove the audience token is not going to have the right OIDC creation payload in it. So now that this application is out there as of, we'll say 1 o'clock today, I can't secure the function until the furthest out scheduled alert has been processed, and that's May 29th, because at that point, anything that was created after, or anything that was scheduled for after that one, that's the oldest one, the furthest out, anything that's created after that is going to be fine. Because it will either have already been processed or it will have been created by the updated alerts function, which has the right code for the payload. Now, the interesting thing is, which, and I wish this was a little more clear in the task side of things too. One of the things that really concerned me about this with securing the functions was, okay, so when you create an OIDC token, the life cycle of that token is 1 hour, right? So after 1 hour, it's expired. So I wasn't quite clear on the creation of the token in regards to if we schedule a task that's goes out older than, you know, further out than an hour. Like, I thought that the token was being created when the task was scheduled and was sitting in there waiting for when it gets pushed out. But no, that's not the way it works. It's that the task scheduler, you put into the payload what is needed to create the token. And the task scheduler, when it sends the request out to the function, creates the token at that point. So then we don't have to worry about, oh, you know, this thing has been scheduled for 10 days from now and the token expired, you know, in an hour, and now it's not going to work. So obviously that makes sense. But their documentation, again, was not very clear on how that works. So I was very disappointed with some of the gaps in their documentation and the very fact that even their own AI tool cannot sift through their documentation and find what I'm looking for.
Don't get me started on that. Yeah.
Wow.
It's like I've been playing around with it quite a bit lately for just stupid stuff, you know. Like one of the things I did was I basically went into Gemini and says, give me a logo with these words on it and certain images, make it like a black and white logo, right?
Uh-huh.
And the words, of course, I spelled right when I typed them in, but invariably Gemini got it wrong. I would say that's great. Because Gemini, you can do like a conversation, all right? So I said, that was good, but you misspelled it. Can you try again? And it still screwed it up. Sometimes it was also adding things that didn't belong there just because, I guess, because it looked good. I don't know. But it's like, you know, anyone who wants to rely on AI for things, be very, very wary of it. That's all I'm saying.
You could have made that image yourself in the amount of time that it took you to keep.
Probably.
That's something.
If I was artistic enough, you know, but, you know, sometimes I'm not, so.
Yeah.
But I did get some good ones. Like, I did one in hiking. Hiking and other kind of things, there's a term called Embrace the Suck. And I got a T-shirt made a logo from Google Gemini that I made with that.
Oh, that's cool.
And it came out nice.
That's nice. Another thing,
but, so you just got to mess with it. That's all you got to do.
Yeah. So, another thing that has been chatting my like. So I talked about Dependabot and how we were using that, but then we had to disable it because it was just creating too much work on with dependencies that require, instead of just like updating the library or module that was being used, it would actually require code changes, and when that happens, then that would create a ticket, and then the tickets kept piling on. And so we decided to disable Dependabot and only enable it like during the winter break, where we could do stuff like that with maintaining code updates and stuff like that to handle any of the breaking changes instead of working on features and stuff. So, of course, like, it's disabled across everything except the one key application that we absolutely would want to have this disabled on, which is on our authentication service, right? And so for some reason, even though the configuration shows that Dependabot is disabled, it runs every first of the month. And it updates it's like a dependency, more of a dependency thing, a dev dependency than an actual dependency. And it breaks the application in a way that the tests don't catch. Like, it's kind of weird. It's like, I think it was back in March, I noticed that our authentication application was not running in development and staging. And the reason why a lot of people may not notice this is because in development and staging environment, the cookie that it creates lasts a little longer. So nobody noticed that they weren't able to properly, like if they were completely logged out and the cookie was gone, they couldn't generate a new one. So that's when I dug into this and I found that, like, I'm like, why is this all of a sudden broken? And we could roll it back to the previous version, but then we look, I was saying it was what Dependabot ran, and it updated this config library. And I'm like, types config library. And it's like, that's really weird. Dependabot was turned off. So we reverted that change, and sure enough, the application's working. Went through, verified that Dependabot is turned off. Now, fine. April comes along, same thing happens again, right? And I'm like, what the hell? And reverted that change, messed around with it, looked up, you know, said, okay, Dependabot is disabled. It's not supposed to run. And sure enough, May 1st goes by, and it runs again. And it's like the annoying thing about this is I can't tell whether it's going to run or not when I make a change, because it only runs on the first of the month and not any other time. So I have to wait until June 1st to see whether this makes, you know, whether what I did. So what I did this time was I said to myself, okay, everything indicates that this thing is disabled. So if you want to enable Dependabot, if you told it enable Dependabot, it would say, well, you need to enable dependency graphing first. Okay. So my thought was, well, maybe I disabled dependency graph and then disabled Dependabot. And now the way I actually need to do that, like the UI did a soft or presented to me like it was disabled, but maybe it really wasn't. Like the UI has a bug in it or something. So therefore what I did this time, and I re-enabled it, and then I went in and I turned off Dependabot and then turned off dependency graph. And I'm going to see if that fixes it a month from now, because I don't know how else to get this thing to stop. It's a pain in the ass. Because every other repo configured the same way, and Dependabot is not running.
Basically, when automation goes apeshit.
Yeah, like when you can't stop it, it won't stop. It's got a mind of its own. And then I look in Google, like, how do you turn Dependabot off? And there's like all sorts of documentation, but they've had such massive changes to this thing. So something in 2020 is not relevant to what was changed in 21 and 22 and 23 and 24. So, you know, of all the things that I've looked at, I can't find anything that says I'm not, you know, that this I'm doing something wrong.
Heh.
But we'll see. We'll see on June 1st when the application breaks again. And it's like one of those things where I got to remind myself or set a reminder to actually go and look to see if the application broke. Because it wasn't even on my mind until somebody had said, oh, you know, that's it. I was working on the functions and stuff like that in Google Cloud Run. And I noticed in there when I came back from vacation on Tuesday when I was looking at it, yesterday I think it was, I was like, oh my goodness, authentication is microservices broken again. But that means that the dependent bot ran. I was like, I got to fix that. And then I went off and did something else, and then somebody else fixed it today. They're like, for some reason it's broken. And like, I could have told you why it's broken, and I should have fixed it yesterday. Because you know why they knew today why it was broken? Because they're working on the migration from Okta to Entra, the stuff that needs to be done for that.
Nice.
Do you work with MySQL databases?
No, not much. We do. Our SaaS product works with Postgres.
Okay.
So that's what they use for that, and. I believe it's – I'm trying to remember. I think it's on Aurora, on top of Aurora, which is Amazon's database service. We don't mess around too much with that, although we use pgAdmin every once in a while to look at things like that. But the managed cloud and our on-prem customers that we work with, they're using Unidata – database backend or SQL or both, because SQL clients technically use both, because there's a handful of files that are still Unidata files, and Unidata is a multi-value database where you might not just have a key, you might have a multi-value key. So, but one of the things that I struggled with this week, well, not struggled this week, was we have a piece of our product called Envision Data Exchange. So basically, anytime we need to transmit data from our ERP system to, like, say, Recruit, which is our CRM based, Microsoft CRM based tool for students. When you apply to the college, you apply through Recruit, and then the data comes from Recruit into the colleague, and then vice versa. So, like, for example, say register for a class or change their address on the colleague side of things, it's going to transmit an EDX transaction to the other system. Well, it's supposed to be real time. It's supposed to automatically go out, and you're not supposed to think about it, right? So we discovered was they were queuing up, and this has happened before. So the process to fix it is usually you just manually transmit everything, then restart that service, and it should automatically pick right back up, right?
Uh-huh.
So that part I got fixed Friday. You know, it took a while because there's like 3,000 pages, and each page has between 10 and 20 transmittals on it. So once I got all those transmitted and got the problem fixed, now they're like, well, why did it happen in the first place? And I go back through our ticketing system, and lo and behold, I found we have a service that's called the Automatic Service Recovery. So I found an incident from that where the process died, and it can happen. You know, it happens enough that we've got documentation on it. So, on how to fix it. So, but the ASR brought it back, but the problem is there was a lag between when it died and when it was brought back. So, and in that time period, it started to accumulate transactions. And once you get to a certain point, the only way to do it is do exactly what I did. So, I wrote an enhancement request so that they can monitor that table and look for records with status of new. And then if there's a status of new, then you alert the appropriate people to go in and fix it so that the client doesn't notice it. So, but that was a fun one. It's all, and I wish I could share more, but it's all proprietary so far as the code goes. You know, there's nothing specific that I can share about how I resolved it. So, but it's still, it's one of those things where it's like, well, you know how to fix it, but then you're like, well, how did it happen in the first place? That's always a good question or an answer that people are going to want to know. And sometimes it takes a minute to find it.
But, yeah.
And it's documentation is key. In fact, that's one of the things I've been working on this week is writing a training on training them how to set up this particular tool that we use. And I'm going through and like I'm looking for things like, okay, now how do I do this step by step? How do I set this up step by this particular subscriber up step by step? And I can't really find it. And it's like, ah. So I want to see if I can't do some searching for it tomorrow and hopefully get that in there. Either way, I can still probably go through that and discuss how to set up the triggers. Because the way it works is it's like it looks at the database and whenever data changes, like say somebody updates their address, it generates a transaction based on that.
Uh-huh.
So, and then that transaction, it basically is an XML file that gets transmitted to the other system. And it can also be the other way around. So you can always accept data via EDX from other systems as well, though it's usually the other way around with us in our case. So, but, and of course there's only one of those, one of those processes. And everyone uses the same process, which means other services are impacted. So there's an integration for another product that was impacted, and of course I had to. And it's one of those things where the folks on the other side don't talk to each other. So what do? They open up another ticket on the same issue I'm already dealing with. You know how it works.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Nobody talks to anybody, and they say, "Did you put a ticket in already?" Yeah.
10 tickets for the same problem.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Ported differently.
Yeah, we'll get the same thing too. Like with alerts. Like we had a client who used up all their licenses today, and we get an alert when the logins start to fail because the licenses are used up. We get an alert. All right, so. And as we started working on it, the client noticed it, and they put a case in, and that triggered another incident and another alert. So it's like nobody bothers to look at what's already happening before it happens. Do that. When you're doing that stuff, when you're working in IT, do that stuff before you put in another case and make life hell. Ugh.
We've been trying to track down a problem with a – I don't want to say it's a problem with a MySQL database, but it is I don't know if it's MySQL or MariaDB. I think it's still MySQL. But it's
could
not,
be either.
It's not a database that we run because it's hosted by VIP. So one of the problems that we're having and I'm not even convinced it is a problem, but – they've been alerting us since for almost a year now that we have a lot of abnormally slow transaction times. And when we start digging into this, like we start unearthing like all this crazy stuff, a couple of weeks ago, maybe a few months ago, we started noticing that as time would go on, we would see a sudden jump in how much, like 5
plus gigs in like an hour, suddenly the database increases by 5 gigs. And it's like,
ouch.
You know, that's like, well, that's odd. What is going on here? Because that is a little too much. Now, and this becomes a problem because when you create a new story in WordPress, it creates this temporary, we'll call it a slug, name or whatever, a slug. It creates this temporary slug, and that gets put in a database until it's replaced by, I think it's the title. So our custom code kind of caused that not to replace that temporary slug. So what was happening is that it generates a random slug so that what it would do is it would have to go through the entire posts table to find the last randomly generated slug value and then generate the next one off of that. So it was like incrementing a value on that generation or whatever it was, right? So it needed to know what the last one was created, and to do that it would have to go through the entire table. So we would see everything would be fine and be fine and be fine and be fine, and all of a sudden it would take like a minute more to actually create a get into the WordPress editor for creating a new story. It would take like a minute. And that's because we had tripped a threshold of the number of entries in that table that caused it to exponentially take longer to resolve that query. We solved that problem, right? But what we were looking at here was, well, why is the database increasing? Like every 12 to 14 days, it would increase by 5 gigs in one, like in between an hour or two. And so what we think is actually going on here is not that it's increasing by 5 gigs in that hour or two, but that somehow their database, when it's checking like values, it's estimating up to a certain point until it actually checks the value, and then all of a sudden you get a jump up. So it's like it might be recording a value every couple of days and then estimating or whatever, not doing a full recording. So we don't think it's accurately showing that jump. We think it's just the way that it samples the information. So then come to find out, like, you know, we still have this slow query problem. Everything that we have tried so far has not resolved the problem of what it keeps identifying as slow queries. And it all seems to me so far, and I don't know, like when you look in New Relic and analyze these slow queries, it comes back to this query that runs, is called SQL calc rows found. And so that query is used by WordPress primarily for like pagination stuff. If you need to pull back all the posts and paginate that stuff. And so I think when you look at the slow queries, these are the ones that come up all the time. Like sometimes they take 10 seconds, sometimes they take a minute to process, and that's really skewing the information. But then if you look at the data in another way, and you look at, you know, what type of transactions are actually going on and how many of them are going on in a minute, you're like, you know, you have transactions are like thousands of running in a minute. And then this specific one that keeps getting tripped by this slow query, this one right here, you have like 74, right, going on in a minute. So I'm thinking to myself, are we trying to solve a problem here that really doesn't exist? I mean, are users having an actual
problem, or are we looking at analysis? And here is this outlying query that we don't know why it keeps running. We can't figure out why it keeps running, what it's actually trying to do here, or where it's causing this. But is it actually impacting the user experience?
Right. Yeah.
Because if it's not, then we just wasting time. Right. Right. Like, ideally, it'd be great to solve this, but why is it? And so, you know, we're trying to figure out, because we're like, well, is it a problem because the amount of information we have in the database, or what's going on here? Are other people having this problem? Like, we're going around in circles with our VIP support. We're not solving the problem, but we don't really even know what the problem is. You know what
Gosh,
I mean? Like,
just sound familiar, man.
Yeah,
we had a similar thing where it was an on-prem customer. I'm not going to say names or anything, but they use SolarWinds for monitoring API accesses. You know, they're looking at the logs specifically from IIS, right? And they're seeing these queries that are just have long run times in the API logs, and they're wondering, well, why is that? And my first question back then was, and I was working this with my Mexico resource. It was her case, and I was helping her with it. And I said, well, has anybody reported any issues with the application? And they said, no. And I'm like, then why do you care? I'm like, you know, I get it. I get it. You want to make sure that this is nothing, and you're being proactive and all that. But you're not actually having any users complain about a problem in the application. So, and it got to the point now where we got some of it down. We helped them with their setup and helped them adjust some things, made some tuning suggestions, and that made it better. But they were still seeing it on occasion, and we finally got them to just drop the issue, because it was just like, you know, is it a client? If your students aren't seeing the problem, then why do you care? What the monitoring, see, what people have to realize, monitoring tools are looking at things from a standard log point, right? So right. they're looking for things that they would expect to see in, like, say, an IIS log or for certain applications, you know. Invariably, that application isn't necessarily the one that you are actually running, you know. So it's going to put things in there that it thinks is unusual that just might not be, you know, because it doesn't understand the log it's reading. So be cognizant of that when you're looking at monitoring tools, because monitoring tools, they're going to look for things that are standard. They're going to look for things like, great example is different HTTP error codes they might look for in the log or something and alert you that you're seeing those in there, you know. But they might see something else, and they might look like to the monitoring tool that it's an actual error when it really isn't.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful of that kind of stuff.
I mean, it's always good to try and solve any problems that you find and optimize
right.
your application, but, you know, just be careful that maybe you're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, you know.
It could be a red herring.
Yeah, just because it might it might not. And I think one of the problems that we're having with this is that the way that they're set up and how they and most probably like 99% of their customers use WordPress is completely different than the way we use it. Like I said, we are not using this as
yep.
a CMS. We are using this as a glorified
editor, right?
Editor, right, for managing this stuff. Because they wanted the framework, not the application, and everything else is just it's like a completely different way than people typically use WordPress. It's just for one part of it, and I think that's what's biting us in the ass. Oh,
yep.
you said is Wait, when is Southeast Linux Fest?
It's coming up. It's next month.
Yeah, it's next month, because I know the call for papers, did it end this past weekend, or is it this coming up weekend by midnight?
Let me look.
Because I got the email for it, and then I forgot about that.
Yeah, let's see. It's the 13th through the 15th. Of course, I can't go because it's my race weekend. Let's see. This year's theme is retro computing. Registration is open. Call for speakers closed on the 27th of April.
Yeah, so it was like a week and a little over a week ago. Yeah, I would love to go this year, but I can't make it. It's the theme is retro computing. That sounds really
right up my alley.
Yeah,
like that's one of the things I need. I need to figure out better setup for my my two retro computers. I got my 800XL and an Apple IIc, and I don't really use either of them that much. Although I guess my Switch will soon be a retro machine too, since the Switch 2 is now. It's not shipping for another few weeks yet. I'd love to get one, but I can't justify it at this point. I'm spent way too much money on things like one part of losing weight that kind of sucks is I keep having to go buy new clothes. because yeah, like I can wear double extra large shirts, but they look like hell on me now because I'm so much smaller. I guess that's a good problem to have in some ways. So not looking a gift horse in the mouth there, but that's the other thing too, is like for training things for example, probably one of the things I'll need to do before my 10K is go get some new Under Armour. Heat gear for that race. Usually one, because I don't, when I run, I don't like to wear like sweatpants, because I just don't like how they feel when I run. So it's like I usually put a pair of like running tights on, and then a pair of shorts over that, Under Armour usually. And I probably need a smaller pair of that so they don't slide down my butt as I'm running.
Uh-huh.
So. Especially since it's November when the 10K is, and that's 6.2 miles. So I got to start also training the longer distances now. But I'll get there. I'll get there. I'm actually not doing too awfully bad now, because one of the things I try to do is I try to run a little faster every day. So like I'm up to like between 2.4 to 2.5. It's as high as 2.6 miles in 30 minutes now. So, and I ran a personal record. When was it? Saturday, I think it was. Yeah. On a 5K, which is like 7 minutes faster than my first 5K race. So, that's a good thing. So. But it's all the tech and stuff, like all the clothes and stuff. It's, I think of things like, okay, now when I do weight training, do I want to just wear my sneakers? That's usually what I do. Or do I want to get something specific for when I'm lifting? Because I don't know. I see like squat shoes, they call them. And I think, will I feel better if I get something like that, or do I really want to spend that much more money on more shoes? Because I got a lot of shoes now. And the shoes I look at least for when I'm running aren't cheap or hiking. So I do got my new trail runners. I need to wear them a few more times before they're broke in yet, although I'm not wearing them on trail because my trail shoes are still in good shape right now. I need to pick up some snacks for my backpack for that first hike too, eventually. And I can't take protein bars. It'll be too damn warm for those. They have stuff at the aid stations though, but sometimes the free stuff at the aid stations, you're like, are not really what you're craving, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
So, do you, when you run, like, if you, you ran races before, right?
I've done them before. Yes.
Right. But when you run, do you like take some of those gels or anything like that?
I didn't take anything.
I didn't think so. Yeah, I know for probably for before the 10K hits, I do want to think about getting like a hydration vest so that I can have water. They only had like gave you a little small cup of water, and I usually will suck down a whole entire camelback of water when I'm at the gym. Camelback is in a bottle, not a water bladder. I'm not a fan of bladders for hiking, because mostly wish I don't like the feel of the water on the back of my back, you know, sloshing around, and because invariably that water you put in the bladder is cold, then the outside of the bladder will sweat, and then whatever's inside of it gets wet, and I don't like that either. So I'm very much taking a water bottle in the water bottle pockets on the pack when I hike.
That's cool.
Yeah. I actually want to look at one of my favorite hikers. She used to work for REI, but she runs her own channel, Miranda Goes Outside. I'm trying to remember the name of the company, but she actually developed a water bottle. Because one real popular water bottle in the hiking community, or water, I should say not bottle, but a brand slash reuse of the bottle, is Smart Water. All right, because the Smart Water bottles usually will fit, they're liter bottles, and they'll usually fit in the water bottle pockets of pretty much any kind of pack, right? But the thing is, you know, they're disposable, and they're made, and they'll reuse them a lot, and they'll use when it's dirty, so they scoop the water up out of the creek, and then they'll run it through a Sawyer squeeze water filter or something so that they can drink it. Well, she has developed her own water bottle that is basically the same kind of form factor, has the same threads that that a Smart Water bottle has, so you can screw it on the end of a Sawyer squeeze water filter and use them when you're on the trail. And the cool thing with them is that they have graduations on the side, which Smart Water bottles don't have, and they can also measure boiling water. So, like, if you're boiling water for a backpacking meal, you can pour the boiled water into this bottle and measure it so that you get the right amount of water into your backpacking meal so that it hydrates right. So, eventually I want to buy one, but they've been they sold out when they went on pre-order. So that's kind of like what I like for water when I'm on trail. And I'll usually throw in like a couple sticks of Element with me while I'm on a hike. I'm planning on doing I'm probably going to try and do, if the weather holds, there's a trail that's actually going to be in good shape because it's mostly gravel. On the west side of Columbus, which actually goes past a pasture where we actually have water buffalo here in Columbus area. And you can see them when you're walking on the trail. It's 9 miles out and back. I've done it before. So I need to do that. And I'm hoping to do that this weekend. We've had so much rain that the trails have been fairly sloppy lately. But I'll get in good shape, good enough shape. And, you know, the thing that I've learned over the last year is you don't really ever stop training. Even if I got to my weight loss goal, which right now is 170, once I get to that, I'm going to stop and go into maintenance mode. But even then, even though I'm not trying to lose weight, I'll still exercise and do things like try and build muscle and stuff and be better than I was the year before. So basically you never stop training. It's taking care of yourself. And that's stuff I've learned. And I'm glad I learned it too.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to start helping people with their training as well. So, you know, you can do. I can get discounted classes through the NASM, so that I can get my certification to be a fitness trainer if I wanted to. I don't know if I want to do that or not, but I wouldn't mind helping people.
You should try it.
Yeah.
We gotta wrap this up. I guess I gotta go help my wife. Anything else you gotta say? Yep.
Nope.
Today is the 7th.
I'll share that water bottle in the Mumble chat as well as in the IRC in case anybody's interested in it. It's actually a pretty neat looking bottle, but the pre-orders have been sold out, which sucks.
How much was it?
It's $15. It's reusable, so I mean, it's not like you know. And that, well, put it this way: the pre-orders were $15. When they go for sale for free, thanks to Air Trump's tariffs, they're probably going to be more. Because of course they are made overseas, China specifically.
Was it a Kickstarter that you got in on for that?
It was not. No, I didn't get in on it. That's the thing. No, it's through a company called Mazama, and it's the MGO bottle.
So they produce a limited run?
Basically, yeah. Murph, I'm glad you can still wear the shirts.
Right.
And they're eventually, I think she said the next run they're probably going to do in other colors other than the blue moon and the lava smoke, so.
What color did you get?
I didn't get any because by the time I watched her video on it, it was already sold out.
Oh.
I'm like, damn it, because I could use about two of them right now.
All right.
Yeah, yep.
I gotta go help the wife with stuff. So,
thank you,
Joel. It's a good show. Thank you. We'll see you in a week, and keep that training going on, man. Doing good.
Absolutely. Doing fantastic.
So here's your promo.
I am short.
Oh my God! It's Hacker
Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
Ah, you know, I forgot to mention.
What's that?
I blew my flexible spending account money on a travel CPAP machine and a battery, so I don't have to have power to go to sleep anymore.
How's it working out?
Well, I don't use it on a daily basis. I still use my regular machine. So this is more for training, but last Saturday I did sleep with it. The big difference with this is it doesn't have the humidification chamber built into it. It has another device for that. But we're at the time of the year where I don't even bother with filling the humidifier up. I usually don't until the winter. But I slept one night with it on the battery. I wanted to test the battery. And the battery, I don't know what the lights mean on it, all right? But it has four lights on it, you know, and when you have all four filled up, it's all charged up, right? So that one night I slept on it, it only burnt one of the batteries out. So I can probably get anywhere between 2 and 3 days battery life sleeping. So one of the things I'm finally going to probably try and do. I might do it this weekend, maybe. I don't know. I have to see. Is to grab a campsite on like a Friday night, go out and build a campfire and, you know, or maybe and grab some food on the way out to the site and then sleep in the back of my Traverse because I have a SUV tent that I haven't used yet. So hopefully that works. But and I'm excited tomorrow I get new protein bars in the mail. Yay! They just brought out a new one on level one for first form level one bars, strawberry smash cake, and they're pretty. I'm hoping they're good. We'll find out. I got a pack of them coming. Great way to get my protein in. So cool. We'll see you, man.
All right, take it easy, man.
Same place on the way back. So
they get to see it twice.
Yeah, actually. And the hotel has it's a Comfort Inn, and it has a swimming pool that's the shape of a guitar. Of course, it's in Nashville, you know.
Well, there you go.
So, yay. Did a PR, I PR'd a 5K on the treadmill this weekend, past weekend.
Well, that's good.
Yep. And my master's degree class started back up. It's a networking one. Yay.
So what?
Just love talking about the AOSI model again.
Oh. Wow. Well, you know, you learn something, right? Learn
not
something.
Really.
Maybe you didn't. How many weeks is this? Are the classes?
8 weeks.
So what? You're on your first week?
Yeah, I just started back up, yeah.
What exactly... So what are you learning in a master's level networking class?
So far, nothing new. we're going to talk about software-defined networks, considering that's literally how 90% of the world works nowadays, with software-defined networks. I mean, that's what I use every day, and I'm sure that's what you use.
When you say software-defined networks, you mean like routing rules and,
yep,
and all that stuff that are defined, load balancing and everything like that,
yeah,
defined through...
Through code or cloud utilities.
Yeah, I guess. I mean... How is that?
It's a good question.
How I guess my you know, when I think of that, I'm like, well, unless you have a what is a hardware-defined network, then?
Well, that's like physical switches and stuff, you know, the data link layer and all that, you know, you have actual hardware you mess with. Nowadays, you don't really mess with hardware. Like when we were first starting out in our careers, we might have had a data center full of servers. Now they're all someplace else, you know? When you think about it, I mean, all your servers are in Google, so.
Yeah, no, I get it. You know, the thing is, though, at some level, it is a hardware-defined network, isn't it?
That's true.
I mean, yep. You still have, they're data centers, but you still have a.
They're virtually there.
You still have the network pipe coming in. It's just disseminated
Yep.
More granularly from a software perspective, but you still have, like, I guess for lack of better words, gateways, routers, and switches in there. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's pretty interesting when you think about it. It used to be like, yeah, it would come in to a data center and you would route it and everything. Oh crap, even earlier than that, like I remember when the school districts, you know, just saying the school district as an example, business the same way, that the servers were physically in the buildings, and there were some that were on the, you know, remotely accessible to the outside, like the web server and stuff. And, you know, and now it's like you may have
egress. You might have a...
Yeah, yeah. You might have like a CDN in front of your stuff, which is in a completely other state than where your actual applications are hosted.
Or even country.
Yeah, which is like completely outside of where you're administering them from. So, yeah, it's become, that's pretty interesting. You know, when you think about it, it's come a long way. I don't know if Joe's showing up tonight.
Completely different.
Was there any?
Where the hell's Dave?
I'm wondering, you know what? Did Dave say he wasn't going to be on?
I don't remember. I know I completely forgotten. I showed up last week and then no one was there. I'm like, oh shit, that's right. Dan's not here.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's get it going. We might have to do. My wife might need help with something when she gets home, so we might have to do a shorter show today if nobody else shows up. We'll just get all our stuff in there. What do we got? Tech show. We got. Big old. No. We don't want to do that one yet. We want to do that.
Self and comes then, next month.
And then we go. And then Joe.
Me.
And then we'll do. And then we'll do that, and then there we go. All right, here we go. This is 198, isn't it? Wait a minute. Did I not do... Oh, 197. What was I thinking? Why was I thinking? Yeah, 197. Okay, here we go.